For what's universal time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Syria's ceasefire generally holding for a third day. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says despite some incidents, the cessation of hostilities is largely intact. Mr. Ban said a multi-nation task force monitoring the truce is working to make sure violations don't spread and the halt in the fighting continues. White House spokesman Josh Earnest Monday also acknowledged reports of violations.
That is consistent with our expectations heading into this process, which is that we did anticipate that there would be reports of violations and that we would encounter some potholes on the road to implementing this successfully.
He said the truce is providing the flow of humanitarian aid to those in need, focuses on defeating the Islamic State, and provides space for a possible political settlement. But opposition spokesman Salem de Mistura said the ceasefire is in jeopardy because of repeated violations by Syrian and Russian forces.
Today there is about 10 Russian airstrikes. There is about 16 airstrikes done by the regime in 26 times. And I believe this should be monitored. And we lost about 18 people and injured about 68.
UN Chief Ban received a letter of complaint from the main opposition group, the High Negotiations Committee. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says both sides may have violated the truce, but they are not significant enough to scuttle the nearly four-day-old ceasefire. Somali authorities have arrested six in connection with Sunday's double bombing by al-Shabaab in the town of Baidoa that killed at least 32 and wounded dozens. Police and the local government said the center of the town, located west of Mogadishu, was very busy when a car bomb exploded near the main market. This is VOA News. In Iraq, a suicide bomber struck a funeral procession in Muqtadiya, north of Baghdad, Monday, killing at least 25 and wounding dozens. The Islamic State claimed responsibility. Separate attacks Sunday killed 24 security force personnel near Abu Ghraib and nearly 80 others in Sadr City near the Iraqi capital. With results in, Iranian voters have dealt hardliners in both parliament and the Assembly of Experts an electoral setback Friday, but analyst Nabil Khoury of the Atlantic Council cautions it does not necessarily signal a change of direction for the Islamic Republic.
Clearly, reformists have made gains in this election, but whether or not this is a historic turning for the whole republic remains to be seen.
State television reported Monday that moderate President Hassan Rouhani and his allies won 15 out of Tehran's 16 seats in the election for the Assembly of Experts. Reformers who favor social freedom and engagement with the West won at least 85 seats in parliament, while moderate conservatives who also favor Iran's nuclear deal with six world powers won 73, giving the two together a majority in the 290-seat parliament. An American college student detained in North Korea has publicly confessed to attempting to steal a political banner from a Pyongyang hotel. Otto Warmbier appeared before a group of domestic and foreign journalists Monday in the North Korean capital, accompanied by guards. U.S. spokesman John Kirby discussed the matter at a Monday news briefing.
In cases where U.S. citizens are reported detained in North Korea, we work closely with the Swedish embassy, which serves as the United States' protecting power in North Korea. As a general practice, North Korea arrests and imprisons people for actions that would not give rise to arrest, let alone imprisonment, in the United States. And there's little doubt that North Korea uses detention as a tool for propaganda purposes.
The 21-year-old University of Virginia student visiting the North with a tour group was arrested last month before boarding a plane to leave. A research group says China's arms exports have nearly doubled in 5 years as the country has moved to become a major player in the global industry. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says Chinese exports of major arms grew nearly 90% between 2011 and 2015. Suspected Ugandan rebels killed at least 12 people, decapitating some in villages in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The rebels, believed linked to the Allied Democratic Forces, an Islamist group with origins in Uganda, attacked at least two villages in North Kivu province early Monday. Britain announced Monday it's sending a training team of some 20 soldiers to Tunisia to help stop illegal entry from neighboring Libya. London is among Western countries concerned about the growing presence of the Islamic State in Libya. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today's Tuesday, March 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. It appears South Sudan rebel troops will now be arriving in Juba today as scheduled.
We are ready to go to Juba, but we are not well informed. This is one. Number two, also the JMAC agreed that they have to talk with the Ethiopian government so that they can approve the transit of weapons from Gambela.
Colonel William Gadjia Denk is the military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. We'll get reaction from the South Sudan government. An IMF team visiting Zimbabwe comments on resumption of financial aid to that country. And Burundi's exiled opposition is not satisfied with the recent African Union delegation visit to Bujumbura.
They didn't emphasize the importance of the peace accord agreement of Arusha. They didn't emphasize the need come around the table of talks.
Panke Simpanye is the deputy spokesman for Burundi's exiled opposition, Sinari. Female artists in Senegal kick off their annual Urban Women Week, and the United Nations says international human rights laws are being grossly violated by states. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. It appears there is another hitch to the arrival in Juba of South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar's forces, a crucial part of the implementation of the agreement signed last August between the Juba government and the SPLM in opposition. A week ago, rebel leader Machar told VOA he was ready to return to Juba once the city had been demilitarized and the first group of 1,370 of his forces had been transported to Juba. Now, SPLA in opposition military spokesman Colonel William Gadjia Deng says the troops will not be arriving in Juba today, Tuesday, as scheduled, because the South Sudan government has not designated cantonment areas as well as provide food and medical care facilities for the troops.
They're supposed to go tomorrow to Juba, but we have a number of prisons that can even prevent our troops to go to Juba. These numbers can be numerated, like the government of South Sudan will designate cantonment areas within Juba, and also they can even provide transportation from Juba. When our troops reach at airport in Juba, also they can be picked from the airport to our cantonment areas. And also from there, we agreed that they can even provide basic life support, like water, food, medical care. So in fact, in our areas, we are ready to go to Juba, but we are not well informed. This is one. Number two, also the JMAC agreed that they have to talk with the Ethiopian government so that they can approve the transit of weapons from Gambela, including our ammunition, light weapons, because our troops cannot just go without approval from the Ethiopian government.
So, Colonel, is the IGAD Plus ready to transport your forces?
Yes, the IGAD Plus. They are the one transported our troops to Juba.
So now you are concerned about accommodation and food and medical facilities when you arrive in Juba?
No, when we arrive in Juba, this will be the responsibility of the government to transport our army to the cantonment areas where JMAC agreed. And also the transportation, including basic life support, like water, food, medical care, this will be responsibility of the government.
You have fought all along in the bush. Can you not just make that sacrifice to come to Juba without food being guaranteed?
No. Basically, this is agreement between the government and the IOU in the watch of international community. We agree that when our troops reach Juba, all these services will be given to them. This is what's being written on the document.
You mentioned the process of verification on the part of the Ethiopian government. I mean, are you saying that the Ethiopian government may not allow you to bring with you your light weapons through Ethiopia?
Yes, exactly. This may happen because we could not attempt that our troops could pass through Ethiopian boundary using these light weapon ammunition and surplus, unless JMAC agreed with the Ethiopian government so that they can allow us to go free through their international airport to Juba.
Talk to the ordinary South Sudanese who might be feeling kind of disappointed when they hear this news.
Anyway, I'm ready to talk to them, because it's not up to us, the forces of IOU, but this is up to the agreement between the partners. If the government is not even serious to fix our containment areas where our troops can be transported immediately from the airport. And if they are not even serious, to do all these facilities like basic life support, like water, food, medical care, all this, and so forth. Also, if JMAX, if they are not speed up to fix our troops, this is not our delay at the IO. We are, in fact, need to go back to our country, I mean, to our capital. And we know that so our people really need peace. And, of course, also we need peace. But if these things are not being done, how could we just go without granting this?
Colonel William Gadjia Deng is the military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. He was speaking with me from Gambela, Ethiopia. Meanwhile, the South Sudan government says it is the fault of the rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar, the fact that their troops will not be arriving in Juba today as part of the peace agreement. Information Minister Michael Makuei says the rebels are to blame for this latest delay because they have failed so far to make available the list of their soldiers who are coming to Juba, as well as the types of weapons they are bringing.
Well, what I know is that the SPLM-AIO has not yet submitted the list of their forces up to this moment to the Troika, the EU and the IPF, who were supposed to transport these soldiers to Juba. The reason is not because of anything other than their failure to organize and submit the list. Movement of the forces outside Juba since last week, and the process is continuing. However, we have slowed down because of the delay in the coming of the SPLM-AIO forces because we cannot leave Juba without security. This is why we have slowed down, and we will continue to phase out. As soon as they begin to arrive, then we'll phase out completely so that they and the remaining SPLA forces and the police would continue to maintain the security of Juba. This is what we are doing. The main issue is not the absence of food, of non-preparation of the site for their accommodation, but the main problem is on the side of the SPLM-AIO, which failed to give the list of these soldiers, NCOs, officers, NCOs and men, to the Troika, to the EU and to the IPF, who are supposed, after the receipt of the list and the type of armaments they have, then they transport them to Juba. The list is not given up to now. How are they expected to be transported without? The problem is not their food. It is not their accommodation. That is not their problem. It is our responsibility, and we have done all the necessary arrangements.
They also mentioned, Mr. Minister, that they have not been guaranteed the process, what they call the process of verification on the part of the Ethiopian government when they are passing or bringing their light weapons through Ethiopia. That process of verification has not been guaranteed.
Well, how can it be guaranteed at a time when they have not given the list? The list of armaments that they have, but they have not given it up to now. Not the list of the armaments, even the list of the personnel who are supposed to be transported have not been given.
So this can be another delay in the implementation process, is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. It is another delay, and the delay this time is on the side of the IO.
Michael Makuei, South Sudan's information minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. The African Union says it will send 200 military advisors and human rights observers to Burundi 10 months into the country's violent political crisis, which came about after President Pierre Nkurunziza decided to run for a third term. As Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, international diplomatic efforts appear to be making little headway.
Five African heads of state were in Burundi last week to push for an end to the crisis. The outcome has been underwhelming for some. Pankaj Chimpanya is deputy spokesman for the political opposition now in exile, CINERED.
We were a bit disappointed by the EU delegation because they didn't emphasize the importance of the peace accord agreement of Arusha. They didn't emphasize the need to come around a table of talks outside the country, talks between Nkurunziza and the CINERED, the opposition. They didn't talk about the AU force.
Rights agencies say at least 400 people have been killed during the crisis. Another 200,000 have fled the country. In December, the African Union proposed sending 5,000 troops to Burundi, but the bloc backed off when the government rejected the initiative. Zuma says Saturday the African Union will now send 100 human rights monitors and 100 military advisers to Burundi. Those monitors may find their work difficult, says Amnesty International researcher Rachel Nicholson.
The situation in Burundi is very tense at the moment, and it's very difficult for human rights observers to carry out their work. We've seen that the situation deteriorated rapidly over the last 10 months, and current trends are frequent arrests of young people, particularly from opposition neighbourhoods. We're seeing that the security situation has also deteriorated.
Zuma also reiterated the African Union's call for inclusive dialogue. The Burundi government has insisted it is ready. But research associate at the Institute for Security Studies in Nairobi, Yolanda Boka, says there is still disagreement about who will participate, even in the wake of these high-level AU and UN visits.
When Ban Ki-moon went to visit Bujumbura a few days ago, the government agreed to inclusive and genuine mediation or negotiation, but they turned around and said that the armed opposition, the Snared, and people who were believed to be involved in the coup would not be invited or involved in the mediation. So this is a bit contradictory when we know that the international community is expecting the mediation to take place along all the relevant stakeholders.
The Burundi opposition says the African Union's choice of mediator could also be holding things up. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni was preoccupied with his own bid for a fifth term in office February 18th. It is a distraction that may continue as tensions remain high in Kampala over the arrest of opposition challengers and alleged vote rigging. Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Today's Tuesday, the first day of March, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The International Monetary Fund resident representative in Zimbabwe, Christian Bedies, says resumption of direct financial aid to Harare might be a long process, and the answer might come in May after the conclusion of an assessment report on Zimbabwe. This comes as an IMF team is currently in the country to assess the final phase of the staff monitored program. Betty spoke with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program about the IMF engagement currently underway in Harare.
Their main task is to do the third and final review under the staff monitor program and also the annual Article 4 consultation, where the team takes a more medium-term look at where does Zimbabwe want to be in like 3 to 5 years, say, and how can they get there. And this is sort of a policy discussion between the team and the various branches of government and the central bank. But of course, we also talk to private sector representatives, NGOs, and civil society.
The staff monitored program, it has ended. So what exactly are they doing now?
It technically ended on the 31st of December 2015, but you cannot assess like quantitative targets, say, on the fiscal balance and so forth, on the same day the year ends. I mean, these things take obviously time to be finalized, but we will still go together with the Article 4 and the third and final review of the SMP that will be presented to our fund IMF Executive Board in May of this year when the mission finalized its report.
There are also reports that Zimbabwe might get new funding, if you may explain that.
This is a long process. You may know that as part of our annual meetings last year, together with the World Bank, the authorities had an opportunity to present a strategy on how to clear the arrears to international financial institutions, and there was broad support for that strategy. Of course, we now have to have a successful completion of that final review of the SMP. That's what the mission is doing right now.
And let's talk about the 1.8 billion in external arrears. How far have you gone in discussing with Zimbabwe on the way forward?
The authorities presented a strategy. That strategy is sound. They have identified financing, and I believe if the Ministry of Finance actually published the broad modalities of what they have in mind in a local newspaper last year after the Lima meeting in October. And so that is still on track. I mean, that's still their plan.
Zimbabwe had given itself a deadline, that is April, to clear the arrears. Is that still realistic?
I think April would be too ambitious.
Christian Bedies is the International Monetary Fund resident representative in Zimbabwe. He was speaking with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program. This week, some female artists in Dakar are kicking off the fourth annual Urban Women Week in Senegal. The Dakar-based celebration features female graffiti artists, rappers, and more. Ina Tiam, a photographer and the manager for Urban Women Week, talks to Ricky Stryak about the importance of the business workshops hosted by the event, as well as how this event helps give a new generation platform for their social messages.
It's a festival specially dedicated to women working on urban culture, and it's about a workshop about leadership and feminine entrepreneurial.
Can you tell us what urban culture means? Is it graffiti? Is it slam poetry? Is it rap music?
Urban culture, like hip-hop, there is hip-hop and poetry, slam. And there is also dance, rap, and photography. The biggest activity is the workshop about leadership and the cipher.
And I believe you said a cipher. Can you explain what a cipher is?
It's a rap activity, but it's not like a concert. But it's like a battle, a rap battle.
These urban art forms are often associated with men. Does that make it harder for women to break through into this area of artistic expression?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. Even for a man, it's also difficult in here in Senegal, because people think that hip-hop is just, it's not like a real job for parents. There is a movement, women artists, but they are young. There are some rappers, dancers, and graffiti artists, but they are young, and they just don't have some experience to be at the same level that men.
And do these female artists often address women's issues in their art, in their music, and their graffiti? Do they speak about issues that specifically pertain to women in society, especially Senegalese society?
Senegalese hip-hop is generally about social living or just politics. So even for women, they are just talking about their own way of life, like to be a woman or Senegalese or African woman doing hip-hop. They just like, yeah, just like what you said, women rights or just those difficult moments that they have.
That was Ina Thiam, manager of Urban Women Week. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says international human rights laws aimed at safeguarding the rights and dignity of human life are increasingly being violated by states for short-term gain. Speaking at the opening of the UN Human Rights Council's 31st session in Geneva, the High Commissioner said the perceived threats of terrorism and extremism are undermining fundamental principles of human rights. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
UN Human Rights Chief Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein calls the piecemeal dismantling of the international system of human rights law deeply alarming. He says this body of law, which was set up to ward off global threats, is being grossly violated by many states which pick and choose those parts that suit their political agendas. He says an increasing number of nations are reacting to the rise of violent extremism, the growing number of armed conflicts, and mass exodus of people fleeing for safety by disregarding basic human rights principles.
Many leaders are pandering to a simplistic nationalism, which mirrors the simplified and destructive us versus them mindset of the extremists and fans a rising wind of prejudice and fear.
The High Commissioner says both international human rights and international humanitarian laws are being shockingly violated with complete impunity in multiple conflicts. He highlights the five-year civil war in Syria, where hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, hospitals and medical personnel purposely targeted, and where starvation is being used as a deliberate and forbidden weapon of war. He notes Syria is far from the only armed conflict where civilians are enduring frightful attacks. He names Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, South Sudan, and Yemen as a few of the many other conflicts where attacks against civilians have become the norm.
Survivors, particularly the most vulnerable, are forced to flee and become exposed to further violations. To keep building higher walls against the flight of these desperate people is an act of cruelty and a delusion.
Though not mentioning them by name, High Commissioner Zaid criticizes the growing number of European countries that are adopting restrictive policies against Syrian and other asylum seekers. He notes that after World War II, nations opened their doors to millions of displaced people. But today, he says, instead of repeating this positive move, states are treating those fleeing conflict and persecution with hostility, disarray, and xenophobia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with volleyball. Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel outplayed Egypt's Smouha in sets of 25-19, 25-18, 19-25 and 31-29 to win the Arab Men's Club Volleyball Championship in Sousse, Tunisia on Sunday. In the bronze medal playoff, Tunisia's CS Sfaxien dismissed Libya's Souheili in straight sets of 25-20, 25-23 and 25-11. Turning to athletics, Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge and Mary Keitany are the men's and women's about world major marathon champions, the leaders of the marathon series revealed in Tokyo, Japan on Sunday. They each accumulated the highest points in their two best outings over the past season. Kipchoge amassed 50 points from winning the men's race at the London and Berlin marathons. In the women's contest, Keitany prevailed at the New York City Marathon and was a runner-up at the London Marathon. Keitany, Ethiopia's Mary Dibaba and Kenya's Hella Kiprop tied on 41 points each. The World Major Marathon Series leaders used an established tie-breaking formula to determine the winner. Kipchoge and Keitany each earn $500,000 for their achievement. The series features marathons in Berlin, Boston, Chicago, London, New York City, and Tokyo, along with the marathon at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China. In football, Nigeria's Super Eagles face yet another challenging technical scenario ahead of their 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers later this month following the sudden resignation of head coach Sunday Oliseh last Friday. The Nigeria Football Federation's technical committee chair, Christopher Green, romped in the under-23 coach Samson Siasia to fill in the gap for now with assistance of Salisu Yusuf, Emmanuel Amuniki and Alois Agu. They have to come up with a winning combination to face Egypt over two legs in less than 3 weeks. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, the first day of March.
This is Bapa Adamare Fota from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. With the current political dispensation in Iran, the manifestation is that Iranians are moving from the wall of destruction and isolation to the wall of construction and assimilation. Thank you. This is Bapa Adamare Fota from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. And that's it for this Tuesday, March 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Madu discusses the latest research in improving the prevention of HIV/AIDS transmission. This week's guest is Dr. Thilsa Pelani Phillips, Director of Network Trials, WITS, Reproductive Health and HIV, South Africa. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Else chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.